Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Kim, welcome back from your vacation. Good to have you back on
Thank
the program.
You. Nice to be back.
Are you rested? Are you ready to go?
I am.
All right.
So, let's go.
Kim is in the seat. Also, we'll talk a little bit later today to Andrew Herman. He comes by, an editor at DNA Info. And one of the things that we'll talk to Andrew about, we do openings and closings. And there was a big Macy's, or it was actually Marshall Field Warehouse redevelopment program going on. And I think it's in just north of Logan Square, and some fighting there. So we'll talk to Andrew about that. We start on Tuesdays with John Najarian. You watch him on CNBC or follow him on Twitter at John Najarian. And he's watching Wall Street for us. Mr. Najarian, welcome back to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Great to be back with you, Stephen. Coming to you tonight from overseas again.
Where are you now, man?
Geneva, Switzerland.
So you were in Greece, you came back, and now you're in Geneva?
Yeah, I had some client meetings in London and then Geneva. Come back tomorrow.
Hey, I'm tempted. You know, I was going to ask you, Jamie Dimon was on CNBC earlier this morning. I don't know if you guys just said something again or had a guest on, because the Dow, which opened low but climbed up now, has given up much of its earlier gains. I think it's up now by about 16 points, and it's dropped from maybe 50 to 60, 16 within the past 20 or 30 minutes or so. You know what that might be about?
Unfortunately, I don't.
Yeah.
The recent drop, anyway. I knew that we had some, you know, benign to good earnings throughout the earnings season, as well as, of course, the employment report last week that was pretty good. So I think overall, the market's doing what all of us would sort of expect without any major catalyst. It's just kind of meandering a little bit higher each day.
I was looking at one of the stories. They said the second quarter earnings are up, I think, you correct me if I'm wrong, but an average of 10.1%, and the predictions were like 6.2%. So it seems like it's been a pretty productive earnings season.
Yeah. Some of it, of course, from a little financial engineering. Some of the companies, you know, through stock buybacks, there are fewer shares out there. So obviously earnings per share look a little better because of that. But most of the companies that have had nice performances after their earnings have not only beaten the estimates, but they've guided higher as well. And that's a whole host of companies, everybody from financial service companies, healthcare, industrial companies, metals and mining. You know, pretty much it's across the board.
Interesting to me that you're overseas now, because, as I said, Jamie Dimon was interviewed, I think it was an hour-long interview on CNBC earlier today, and it kind of was, it wasn't his mea culpa at all, but he sort of cleaned up his language when he said earlier he might be, you know, he was embarrassed going overseas because of the situation with taxes and infrastructure and government here. This morning he said, America's the best country on the planet. I'm a complete patriot, but we should acknowledge our problems and fix them. And he's talking about the need for tax reform and regulation. And so there you are sitting overseas. He says, you know, that everyone else around the world has recognized the situation, fixed their tax issues, where in the last 20 years, ours has only gotten worse. What's the rest of the world saying about us?
It's not so much what they're saying about us, at least from my perspective right now, although, as I told you a week ago, they were pretty enthused about the prospects for America going forward, especially since the dollar had weakened so much that a lot of the exporting companies in the Dow and S&P would do much, much better, because obviously the goods are priced at a lower valuation in the local currency. But I think Jamie's spot on as far as the infrastructure. When was the last new airport in the United States? Probably Denver, really. And there just hasn't been a lot of money spent on infrastructure. And I think that's one of the things that's kind of glaring when you come over and see brand new airports and rail systems and public transportation, as you are also mentioned. Some taxes that are much more competitive with the rest of the world that keeps their companies from hoarding so much money outside of the borders.
You know, it's funny. I take groups to Europe a few times a year, and, you know, we think of the old world and new world. It's such a glistening modern display over there. with so many of their, whether it's their airports or their train stations or whatever, they've just continued to build.
Yeah, a lot of the, certainly here in Switzerland, the infrastructure, Stephen, I'm sure you've seen it many times, but it is amazing. It's so easy to get around. So much of it's on the honor system, too. I mean, the light rails that run down the middle of the sidewalks, we were just commenting on it. I can't imagine that in Chicago we could do that and have more than 20% of the people actually pay because, you know, you just hop on,
right,
hop off wherever you like. There's no stations. It would be, I think, I don't know that you can change in the middle of someone's lifetime and all of a sudden give them access to something basically where they could have a choice to pay or not pay.
That'll be a fun experiment anyway. One of the other things Diamond talked about was education reform, and that sort of ties into the job openings today. I don't know if you saw the report, but job openings up 8%, 6.2 million new jobs available in June, but the hiring wasn't up so much, and they say that's because, you know, the employers are sort of struggling to find qualified people to take the jobs.
Yeah, and it's probably the first thing that we see prior to some of the wage inflation that hopefully we do see in the next few months. And that's, you know, if you can't get the qualified people at the wage you're willing to pay,
right,
you try moving up the wage and then see if that does indeed get those qualified applicants. And that's one of the things I think we're all sort of anticipating, and that's probably where the inflation starts picking up. But at least that's what the Fed has been waiting for all this time, is that pickup in the wage inflation.
Yeah, a lot of workers have been waiting for that too, so good luck with that. Let's talk earnings a little bit. Disney, with their report later today, it seems like every quarter now people start talking about the drag that ESPN is on Disney.
Yeah, and they keep talking about whether or not they might spin it out. Given that Scripps and some of these other companies are getting together and doing mergers, could there be somebody out there to be big enough to take something that's 50% of Disney's revenue, which is ESPN? I don't think so yet, Stephen, but I think that it should be a pretty strong quarter for them, given the amount of money from the theme parks as well as Guardians of the Galaxy and some of their successes at the movies this past quarter.
As far as the rest of the earnings season, we're waiting this is going to be sort of retail week. What's ahead for us?
Well, yeah, retail has, we've seen a lot of action this week and last week in JCPenney, for instance, JCP. It's a very cheap stock. I believe it's right around $6 a share. And so a lot of people are betting that that one might see a little turnaround here. Jimmy Choo getting bought by Michael Kors, I think you'll see a lot of consolidation, but I'm not really looking for blowout earnings from most of the retail space, but I think some of them may be cheap enough that you can take shots on Kohl's, KSS, and Macy's, symbol M, as well as Under Armour, UAA. I kind of like all three of those right now.
All right, what else are you watching today? You got another tip for us?
Well, we were doing a lot of Snapchat, and that's been working out very well lately. It bottomed out last week under $12 a share and had a very nice pop. We sold out about half of the position, but we're still in there and looking for maybe a little good news for a change after their first quarter was so horrible. So we're in Snap, SNAP.
All right, John Najarian. Well, listen, enjoy your time in Switzerland, get some good work done, and have a safe trip back. We'll talk to you next week.
Thanks very much, Stephen.
You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. We'll talk to Suzanne Muchian a little bit later in the program. She is the co-host of The Big Payoff, talks about gender issues in tech and in the workplace. And that certainly has been a case, forever, I guess. But what's going on in Google makes headlines, and we'll talk to Suzanne about that a little bit later in the program. Right now, Andrew Herman is in the studio, an editor at DNA Info. Talks about what's opening and what's closing and I guess maybe what's rebuilding. Welcome back.
What's trying to open?
Yeah. All right, tell me about this. It's called The Fields Project. Mm-hmm. It's an old Marshall Fields warehouse.
Right, right.
And it's in, it's just north of Logan Square?
It's in Avondale. It's basically, it's at Diversey and the Kennedy.
Okay.
And I don't know if you ever went to the Fields warehouse, but they used to have these gigantic furniture sales.
I can remember that.
You know, traffic would be backed up for miles.
It'd be a weekend thing, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and I actually bought some furniture there.
Did you really?
Way back then. Yeah, and anyway, so they moved out in the early 2000s, and then they were, you know, bought by Macy's. But there's been this huge building there, and a guy has purchased it, and he wants to make some living quarters out of it. And initially, he had a plan where he was going to build work-live apartments, and basically, if you had, if you worked out of your home or you had a small business, you could, this would be a place where you could live and it'd be in the city and it'd be close.
So kind of like a quasi, not an incubator, but, you know, a business.
Kind of like an incubator where you live.
Right.
But then he found out that it got complicated because he thought, well, you might need business licenses, which to, in order to live there. And then that kind of cuts down the market. And so he came up with a new plan. And it's 120 units, half of them studios, 31 one-bedrooms, and 18 two-bedrooms. And he says, you know, this is what I think the market wants in this place. Well, he's run into sort of a buzzsaw from the neighborhood. And there was a local meeting recently, and a lot of Hispanic families showed up, and they're basically saying, this is a form of gentrification. You are not building units for us, for families.
We're Hispanic families. We're not two people and a dog.
Right.
We've got two and three kids. We need two and three bedrooms.
Right. And, you know, you think of gentrification of, you know, wealthier people moving into neighborhoods that are sort of a lower economic class and buying their buildings and pushing them out. But this is sort of a gentrification ahead of the case, right?
Right.
So they're saying if you don't start building units that we can use because we're families, you're going to push us out of this neighborhood. Now, the alderman, Millie Santiago, she's supporting this project. And her argument is that, well, this development's going to have about a dozen affordable units, lesser cost.
Which is
units.
An increase of than what it originally had proposed, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, she's been out there negotiating. But it is an interesting aspect. And we see this throughout the city and in a lot of the neighborhoods about this gentrification problem, which is basically you have people with higher incomes moving in. The home values are going up at a certain rate, and the people are generally have a higher education. So that's how you sort of identify a gentrified
neighbor. Yeah, and this is kind of an interesting one because it's even though so he's building studio apartments.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like wealthy people are building houses or condos, right? So
the
population might be toward more affluence, but maybe they're not there when they're renting a studio apartment. I'm not sure the words I'm using, but
yes.
Something
no, there. I know what you mean. It's almost like these are the types of people who will be moving into the upper level eventually, but right now this is all they can afford. They're upwardly mobile, I guess you could say.
And they're passing through.
Right, and this is, and they may stay in the area. I think that's sort of the value of this is you try to create housing for people who might have a future in the city itself, which applies to both groups, right? The Hispanic families and the sort of young, upwardly mobile people.
And the thing about the development, too, is we're talking about really just 10% of it. 10% of this whole development is residential. A lot of
it's a big retail thing. So they'll have a fancy grocery store.
I'm running late, and if I run behind, my producer Bennett Wignight has a conniption.
All right,
we don't want a conniption.
Okay, right.
Tell me about that.
The word of the day.
Yeah.
So you know, you wonder about small businesses and how they come up with their names. Our reporter in Wicker Park recently did a profile of a place called Conniption, 1141 North Ashland. It's in Westtown. It's an ice cream sandwich place, and the product looks awesome.
It's not just ice cream sandwich. It's like a churro ice cream sandwich,
Yeah, very fancy stuff. But she asked, how did you come up with this name? And the owner says, well, we had about 80 different names, and we just couldn't settle on one. And one of the partners said, if we don't come up with a name, I'm going to have a conniption. And the other one said, that's it, conniption.
Eureka, and there it is.
Yeah.
And they're like a permanent food truck.
They're behind a restaurant, right.
But in a truck without wheels, right?
Yeah.
I mean, just sitting there.
Yeah. So, but they have some very fancy ice cream sandwiches, about $5 a piece, but they're pretty big. And like you say, they're made of churros, and they also make some with fruity pebbles, if you can stand that. and brownies and whatever. But I really like the idea of naming your restaurant Conniption just based on something that comes out of somebody's mouth.
That's Andrew Herman. You can read more about that at DNA Info Chicago. Thanks for coming by.
Okay.
Here we sit along the Michigan Avenue in the Allstate Showcase Studio, a beautiful summer day in Chicago. What could make it better? Oh, I know. Suzanne Mushin in the studio.
Wait, remember the day that we reported incorrectly that there was a rainstorm just right, on this right. part of Michigan, and it was really the fire trucks or something watering the plants?
They were watering the planters in the middle, yeah. but it looked like it rained on half the street.
It did. So we really shouldn't be the weather people here, I feel.
No, let's do sports.
Okay.
Suzanne is the co-host of
so
The Big Payoff.
That.
You can listen to her at WGNplus.com, and we talk about we talk about Google and gender. That's what we talk about. Wow. So it's always bubbling under or bubbling over this idea of gender equality, pay equality, and Google seems to be at the forefront of it. This guy writes a memo, a 10-page sort of memo, internal.
3,000 words.
In an area where ideas are supposed to be shared.
Yeah.
He did it quasi-publicly, and then he gets fired. Now he said some...
stupid things.
Stupid things.
Were you going to... I was going to say stupid.
I was going to say indefensible, but stupid's better, yeah. I think, because they do seem to be kind of stupid. But here's one thing he said. Mm-hmm. He said we shouldn't be so focused on gender equality. We should be focused on ideological equality. He said, because everyone is going into this group think, and if anyone wavers from that, they are punished. He wavered from it. And he got fired.
He went well beyond
I know,
wavering.
But was that a self-fulfilling prophecy a little bit?
It could be. If he had stayed there, I think he would have had something to talk about that wouldn't have resulted in him getting fired. But he had more things to say than that, Steve. So let's just go to some of the highlights, my favorite things he said about women. And also,
do we need music behind this?
I would like something a little, I would say like a girl power, maybe a little Sheryl Crow.
Oh, I was thinking maybe like soft music.
Oh, you were?
Yeah, gentle girl power.
Gentle girl power? Okay. Oh, maybe that's true. Something that reads more like a sort of like ladies commercial for right. like lady products.
Exactly, right.
Okay, so
was
he says...
Wasn't exactly what I was thinking, but it fits.
All right, well, Bennett with his new beard, I'm sure that's added some talent in the music finding department. Okay, so he says these are some of the things that make women not as good at their job at Google. I mean, that's his main point.
Not as good at being
an engineer.
Software engineer.
And so maybe this whole discussion around the pipeline and the gap. So he says, women are more open about feelings and aesthetics. They empathize and have more interest in people than things. They are interested in careers that are social or artistic. And then he says they are generally having a harder time negotiating their salary because they just are really too gregarious rather than assertive. That's his word. And then finally, that women tend towards neuroticism, higher anxiety, and have a lower stress tolerance. I don't even know where to begin with any of that.
Well, you know, you don't have your headphones on, but Bennett just accompanied that with some very beautiful.
Was
sort
it?
Of,
how did I sound?
You sounded great. I think it was kind of like Up With People without the singer.
Oh, nice.
Music.
I liked Up With People.
Right. So he's all wrong. He's completely.
He's taking a set of generic caricatures of women.
To me, living up to the stereotype. He's the guy who
totally.
Sits alone at lunch
right
and stares at
in
everyone
front of
else.
His computer. But here's, I think, the most beautiful responses. The fact that he got fired, I think, was the right thing to do for Google's culture and for their brand, to be honest.
Okay. Is there any point to the fact that he got fired for...
Speaking his mind.
I mean, as Bennett was saying, I don't want to throw Bennett under the bus. We were talking about it before. And he said, well, if he had said the earth was flat, that's really stupid and wrong, too. You wouldn't fire him for it.
Correct.
So what makes this a fireable offense other than the outside factors going on?
Well, I think that the main point that they were making there is that it really did go towards creating harm in the culture and harm towards a particular group of people who work at Google, namely women. I mean, look, if all of that was said instead of about women, but of like African Americans or Latinos, you know, it twists the comments in a direction that I think is really bad for Google. Okay. I 100% support his being fired. I really do.
I think I think you're right. It does make Google look bad.
Yeah.
But I'm interested in the, and I don't want to defend him.
No.
But I find that I am in a way, but I think it's interesting that he talked about this ideological sort of
left
litmus
versus right.
Test. Yeah, yeah, and he's a right guy. He said that, you know, you need to allow more conservatives. He argued about that, and then that's what did him in.
I do want to say that there was a great response from someone, which I think went right to the heart of why this was a problematic post, which was a guy who worked at Google for many years who basically said, look, the thing he was most wrong about is about what it actually takes to be an engineer. So he said, essentially, engineering is all about cooperation, collaboration, and empathy for your colleagues and customers.
Well, those are all girl qualities.
That's so girl stuff, Steve. But it's true that those are the qualities that the guy who wrote the manifesto claimed were in the female toolbox.
Okay, so let's move on from there.
Can I use female toolbox on this show?
Well, I'm not going to use it. We were going to talk last week, and then you got derailed on something.
You derailed me. There's no me derailing myself on this show.
This notion of, and I love this, benevolent sexism.
You like benevolent? You like being a benevolent
sexist? No, I like being the beneficiary. Tell me what.
I feel like I treat you a little this way.
But there's something real here.
There is.
I don't agree with everything that they were saying about it, but it's kind of an interesting idea.
So the Harvard Business Review had this great review on the gender issue that occurs when men are actually well intended.
Can I tuck that in for you? Are you okay?
See, you're so good that sometimes I fall for you. It's exactly what Steve, they're well-intended, but actually trying to be helpful to women in a way that's ultimately not helpful to them. And so it says, benevolent sexism, it's a chivalrous attitude, but it suggests that women are weak.
So it could be good well-intentioned, a good-intentioned guy who will treat a woman in a different way than he would the man, and so that ends up...
Right. Like, let's say if you and I were in a meeting and we were talking about the quality of this segment and why it was good. And you said, you know, look, Suzanne's really warm. She just seems to connect with the audience.
Yeah, I don't get that. That's exactly my. So it's I agree with you that it's there that you can say, well, let me help you out with this. Or can I get that for you? And the implication is you can't handle it on your own. But then some of the words they assign as being signs of it, like warm.
Yes.
Nice. Connecting. Nice. I'm sorry. I think those are positive terms, and I wish they would be. I would love it if people would apply them to me too. So I don't quite get how warm implies benevolent sexism.
I think you wouldn't mind it, nor would I, if there was a both and. If the other words like intelligent, charismatic, experienced, skilled, if those words were also used in addition to saying you're warm, you're nice, I think the problem is that the words that they call communal words, which are part of benevolent sexism, aren't often accompanied by the harder hitting side, which is she's smart, she's well trained, she's had a ton of experience. And the men, again, are not doing this in a bad way.
Right.
They're not really trying. And in fact, in most cases, I think they're trying to support women. And this article is just saying you need to be a little bit more mindful.
Call her a hard ass and move on.
Call her a badass and move on.
Suzanne Muchin, it's time for you to get out of here. You've got to move on.
Can I get you a muffin?
No, never bring food to meetings. You taught me that.
I did. Never, women. If you take one thing away from this segment, do not offer your male colleagues. Don't offer to get them food.
Listen to her at The Big Payoff at WGNradio.com. All right, see you next week.
See you next week.
It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. All right, content is king, right? You hear that all of the time. The name of the book from Bharat Anand, a professor of business administration at Harvard, is called The Content Trap, A Strategist's Guide to Digital Change. He joins us now on a phone line. Professor, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Thank you, Steve. Pleasure to be here.
All right, so I'm interested in this because, of course, here I am in radio, and so many different media industries were kind of the first to face this digital challenge, how to maintain business, how to grow business in a digital world. And you started sort of studying that. You called newspapers, magazines, even radio, I would imagine, sort of the canaries in the coal mine with this. Explain that for me.
Yeah, no. So digital, as you know, Steve, is obviously a topic, an issue that confronts almost every business today in the economy. You know, from retail to financial services to education. And, you know, part of the motivation for what I was studying was, it turns out there's a part of the sector, a part of the economy, which is the media entertainment sector. As you said, newspapers, radio, magazines, TV, which have been experiencing digital change for 25 years. And so the question is, what can we learn from their experiences that might travel elsewhere? So they, if you will, they are the canaries in the digital coal mine.
In a way, really, every company is a digital company now. I mean, every company has to have some sort of digital presence or strategy in order to succeed, I would imagine, other than a kid's lemonade stand on the corner.
Yeah, and you could take it a step further. I mean, you could even argue everyone's a media company today because everyone can reach their customers directly, right, through social media as opposed to going through traditional media channels.
So what? Tell me about this idea that content is king, because that's what sort of we went through. You know, I used to provide content for BarnesandNoble.com, and when they were really beefing up their author interviews and different you know, pieces online, content is king. If we have the content there, that will bring people to our website and grow our business. You seem to argue that that's not necessarily the case.
Yeah, in some sense, you know, I think what's ended up happening is the cost of creating content, the entry barriers, so to speak, have reduced dramatically, right? So almost anyone can make content now. I mean, the numbers are somewhat staggering.
It's really true.
You know,
yeah.
300,000 books published every year. You know, the number of videos. I mean, we just have to look at any video site. And so in some sense, you know, if you go back to the axiom, a lot of people used to talk about content is king or distribution is king. I mean, in some sense, the axiom itself was never true. It was always the case that differentiated content or scarce content was king. And I think part of what we're seeing today is both a blessing, which is great content is rewarded, but the curse, which is everyone can produce content, and so you have tremendous clutter. And how do you break through that?
And so you talk about connections and creating connections with the audience or with the customers. Explain that for me.
Yeah, I mean, so if you go back, you know, and think about how the impact of digital has played out, and this is not just about the impact on the media sector, but elsewhere, there's a very strong tendency to look at digital technologies or online as just another distribution channel. In other words, you know, online came along, oh, we can actually sell ebooks, or we can put, you know, news content through websites and so on and so forth. And while that's true and it allows you to reach more customers to get the word out, in a sense that only scratches the surface of what digital technologies really offer companies. It's a bit like if you were to think of companies as a hub and spoke model, where you make content or product in the hub and the consumers are in the spokes. Yeah, the promise of digital is to increase the spokes dramatically. But then you start realizing, wait, the spokes can also talk back to us. They can interact with us. We can get feedback from them. We may like it or not, but that's a huge benefit.
So if you have a way to engage them, rather than providing them with the great American novel, if you engage them with the discussion about that novel, you're more likely to create sort of a loyal relationship.
That's exactly right. And so that's engagement as opposed to just receiving marketing messages.
And
but then you can go beyond that, Steve, because where things start to get really interesting is when you realize the spokes can also talk to each other, right? Not just to the hub.
Right.
And those interactions can be really powerful and surprising.
And so tell me, give me a quick example of that. We're about out of time, but explain for me then how, as a hub, if I sort of lose a little control, my spokes start talking to each other, how does that work for me?
So here's a story that might be interesting. So there's a Norwegian media firm called Schibsted. There was this volcanic ash crisis in Iceland several years ago.
Right.
You know, you might think that the most popular stories at that time are what are the weather patterns, what are the health implications, and so on. It turns out none of that was interesting to their readers. Basically, air travel was disrupted. Their readers were simply putting messages up saying, how do we get from Oslo to Trondheim? And other readers were responding saying, oh, I'm driving a car. I can take three people at the train station at 3 o'clock. They see this and they create an app within 7 hours called the Hitchhiker Central. All that it did was allow people to connect to each other. And this became the most popular app during the crisis.
That's fascinating.
So that's an example, which is, you know, I mean, they started asking this question, how can we help readers help each other, which really defined their approach to covering any kind of content.
And rather than Central going out, they helped the people out connecting to each other. Bharat
that's
Anand,
right.
The professor of business administration at Harvard. Name of the book, The Content Trap. Professor, thanks very much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to you.
You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch.